We on? Now then, Ray Winston here. The real one. Close enough. Doing a new podcast with me mate Tony. Soprano, that is.
Oh, how you doing?
Talking all the big stuff. Birds, scraps, films.
And of course, men's mental health. With studio guests such as arch feminist and top broad Deborah Francis White and disgraced scumbag comedian Dapper Laughs.
Something for everyone. We're trying to be better men, ain't we, Tone?
That's right. We're bad boys done good.
Available on YouTube and to download on all good audio platforms. Go on, get off your hands, you dopey c***.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to another edition of your favourite podcast, Insane in the Membrane.
Insane in the Membrane.
Here we are, 100th show, 2 years in. Who'd have thought it? Who would have thought that we would have gotten this far? But we have, and we have got it this far thanks to you. For you guys, for your continued support, for keeping us going and for helping us keep the lights on and just basically being involved. We really appreciate it. Couldn't have done it without you. Couldn't have done it without producer Paul. Couldn't have done it on my own. I want to thank everybody. It's 2 years. 2 years. It's flown by, isn't it? It's absolutely flown by. This last year, obviously, not been the best. But you know what? We have continued to bring you the best in podcasting with some phenomenal guests. So we thought what we'd do this time, because you know, normally we would have had a big celebration. We would have done a live one. We would have done this, that and the other. But unfortunately, as we are all still, you know, locked in our houses and we're not allowed to be anywhere near each other, we just thought, right, what we'll do, we'll put a compilation together to show you some of the highlights of some previous shows and previous guests. You know, so we've had Romesh Ranganathan, Ishan Akbar, we've had Michael Smiley, James Acaster, Rob Beckett, and we've had all sorts of guests. And we've had Heston Blumenthal was on. That was a blinder, wasn't it? Heston, my word, what a dude he was. And we've had some really amazing conversations with people. It just goes to show you, doesn't it, that even though people, it doesn't matter where people are or how successful that we sort of they seem to be, when you really get down to it, everybody's the same. Everyone feels the same. You know, we have the same insecurities and the same, you know, our confidence goes up and down depending on how much sleep we've had and what's happening in our lives. And it's been really interesting to talk to people on here and find that out. You know, it's been a real eye opener. I've learned so much from doing this podcast. I'm definitely a different person from when I started out. My confidence is a lot better. My general outlook on life is a lot better. My self-esteem is through the roof. But not in a big-headed way. I feel different. I feel great. And that's thanks to this podcast and the people that have been on. So thanks to all of our magical guests. And again, for you guys as well. You all the messages I receive from everybody. And the back and forth, the conversations we have with all the guests, with all of you guys, it's just fantastic. So thank you very much. It really, there is a real sense of community I feel that has built around this podcast. So to coming up in a moment, it's some of the best bits of the last 2 years.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
A podcast from producer Paul.co.uk.
Okay, so here we are. We're into it. I tell you what, it was putting this together. Thank you to producer Paul, who really put in the graft. Yeah, because there's been so many highlights throughout the conversations that we've had. Difficult to sort of pick out a few, pick out some of the best ones. I mean, they're all brilliant. That's the thing. This has been quite the challenge for producer Paul. Well done, mate. So you know what? We're going to start with Rob Beckett. Now, Rob Beckett was one of the earliest interviews that we had back at the start of 2019. And I've known Rob for a while. I used to play comedians football with him, and I've written stuff with him. And we've had a good relationship anyway. And it was really nice to go and visit him when we were allowed. This is the thing. This is back before all this carnage that happened. And I actually went to his house, and he was so open and honest about his own insecurities and his own feelings about certain things. It was the kind of chat that has become synonymous with Insane in the Membrane. Like, people really do open up, which is a really wonderful thing to experience. You know, these people might be all over the TV and like stand on stage in front of tens of thousands of people, but you know, like I said earlier, they share the same vulnerabilities and insecurities as you and me. And also, these aren't just highlights, by the way. This is going to be like chunks of the conversations that we had. We just thought that we'd pull these ones out. And if there's any others, if you're listening to this and you're like, oh, I remember this one, this was a good one, drop me a line and then we'll have a chat about that later on, on another edition. Because it's always nice to hear feedback and bits you've loved and things like that. So anyway, look, let's begin. This is Rob Beckett.
I can go for a stage where I feel like absolutely unstoppable. Like, yeah. I'm going to fucking do anything I want. This is ridiculous. Do you know what I mean? Yeah. The point would be like, what are we having for the mortgage next week? I know for a fact there is enough for the mortgage.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, at least you can look at the bank and go, right, we've definitely got at least 3 months, right? I know for a fact.
I'm all good.
But I will be worried about the next one, even though it's sort of totally like over the top of catastrophic thinking for no reason. But then you just sort of, I use a lot of like, you know, mindfulness and CBT and stuff like that to sort of acknowledge that feeling.
Yeah.
Sometimes if I'm feeling really fed up or like, got no like respect for myself and just like you're not actually any good. Well, that's negative.
Right.
I write bullet point every one of those negative thoughts, right? And just log them. And then don't go over them, just put them away, put them in my bag or whatever. Yeah. And then either make a conscious decision when I'm feeling up to look at that list, and then I write my response. So it's almost like my negative brain actually talks to my positive brain. So then I go down and sometimes I laugh and I go, I can't believe at some point I thought I weren't any good at this.
I'm a legend.
Yeah, exactly. But then hopefully you're back somewhere in the middle.
Yeah, right.
But I've done that before and that really helped, where I had that written down on one side and I was looking at it and I go, that's insane. I can't believe I thought that.
Well, that's the thing. We're lucky to do what we do. But at the same time, like everything, it comes with its own stresses.
Yeah.
And it sounds like you've got a handle on how you handle those stresses. You've got your things that you do. And
well, when I started 10 years ago, and then after about two or three years, I got a job doing the I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here Now, which was a massive show on ITV2, still is, obviously. Yeah. Gets like 1 or 2 million viewers, which is massive, right? Yeah. So that for me was a great opportunity, but I went on and I was very green. I was all right, but not as good as Russell Kane, who I was replacing.
Right, yeah.
Russell Kane is one of the best live performers in the country. Yeah. Like, when he's on full on a tour, he's incredible, right? So I was following him after him doing 3 years, and I was all right, but I got absolutely killed on Twitter. I'd say 100 tweets after every show.
Really?
Who's this shit fat idiot, like sort of stuff about like my what I look like, no. my weight, my comedy, just everything, you know, just abuse and abuse and abuse. So like loads of it, and it was all quite new social media then as well.
My
followers are going up and all that, but it was just like, and it was 21 days in a row of doing the show,
and every day was just
so I could work nights, so you got picked up at 10 at night, got taken to a jungle, I had to watch the show and I had to write 3 minutes of stand up about the show with no writer or anyone, just on my own.
Wow.
And then we rehearsed it and I did it live on the show at 8 a.m. in the morning.
And had anyone gone over it to go?
It was Steve Parry, who's a brilliant comedy writer, the actual words of the show that like Laura Whitmore would use to present the show.
Right.
And he'd come with me and go over it and like work through it with me. But he had another job. He only did that because he was a pal and he was being helpful. But I had to write 3 minutes of stand up every day, and some days were good, some days were bad.
Wow.
And I had to write a bit for the end. So it was really intense.
And this is your first big TV job?
TV thing. Also, I've never even done a school play. I did some open mic gigs, did the Edinburgh Fringe, got on the telly, and now I'm just on the telly on my own. No idea what I'm doing.
And you're the other side of the world as well.
I didn't even have a laptop, I had to buy a laptop for it. And I'm in the other side of the world in the jungle doing nights. Following Ant and Dec.
Oh man.
So I did 21 shows in a row, because that's what it is. Brutal schedule, killer. And then I just come home and I was just so down. I just killed me. Exhausted me, and I had all this negativity coming about me. And everyone was going, all my mates thought I got paid like £10 million. So they all thought, you didn't really, it was like good, decent money, but it weren't life-changing money. No. Like, it was just like, it was basically, that job was like having a decent office job.
Yeah.
I had to work 1 month for it, right? Yeah. Which is good, but then...
And you were getting that sold out abuse.
Yeah, but I don't fucking work anywhere else. So basically, I just had the same money as my mates was working in an office. Everyone thought I was like king of the telly. And then loads of people shouting and stuff at me from like... Because basically, I come back from that and I was basically famous.
Yeah.
Like in that small world of people that watch it. Not like mega famous, but...
Well, I remember when you and I, we'd go and play squash.
Yes.
And then there was that... It was one time that we were just queuing up to pay and there was... Yeah. You could see people, they weren't necessarily coming over to you.
But it was a different reaction. And it literally went from, literally within a month, and I didn't notice it gradually because I was in Australia, and I come back after a month and it was like, oh, you're a bit famous now. But like instantly. It wasn't any sort of slow process, because 2 million people watching you every night for...
They just knew you.
Yeah, and it was all just like normal people in the street type people watching that show. So then I found that really, really difficult. I just wasn't coping with it, really stressed. And then I was really just down. So then I went to the GP, and then they just referred me for some like counselling sessions.
Yeah.
So I had like 10 counselling sessions all on the NHS. And that was amazing. It was really good because I could talk it all through, work it all out.
Brilliant.
And then I read the Ruby Wax book, The Same New World, which was like my Bible of calming my brain down a bit. And everything she said she went through, I was like, oh, that's what I'm like. And I find a lot of stuff about mental health, the books are too wordy and too academic.
Yeah.
This book's great. So I read that, did loads of CBT, and then did mindfulness, meditation, which really helped. And then recently, I do the, if I'm lacking a bit of confidence, do like, you know, motivational things.
The same thing
I listen to if I'm going to the gym. Do you know what I mean? But like, I might listen to that before a gig. I love doing stand-up. So my ideal like night out is to go and do a gig.
Yeah.
I fucking love gigging. You know, like sometimes it's not if you've got a drive to the middle of nowhere or you've done for 10 minutes, but like if I've got a bit of time off perfectly, like let's go to do a gig in a nice club, we're on the bill with like mates like you're on a mates, and then have a couple of beers after.
Love
like,
it.
That you know, I just love doing it, but there's people that get into it because they want to be famous, they love the idea of being a comic rather than the actual graft of doing it.
Yeah, right.
And I think they're the ones that get a little bit, you know, easily caught up and get a bit flash and stuff like that. And sometimes it's not many comedians are like it.
No.
Because you've got a tangible skill.
Yeah.
So like when I go out and I get you do a gig and they love it.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, I feel content. That's good feeling. And also people watch it and go, oh, he's good.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're sometimes if you're like on telly, like reality star. So then sometimes I act like a bit of a star in order to get the respect. So go, I'll leave him waiting and all that kind of stuff. But what I do is I ring people bang on the time I'm telling them I'm going to ring them a bit earlier to be really keen. Because that panics them more than ringing late. Everyone rings late.
Well, that was it. I mean, I've done a few of these now and I've gone to people's houses and I've made a point of being on time and you know, because I don't know, I just don't want to, I don't want to think I'm a dick. I'm doing this, I'm just professional.
My aim would be like to get to like the biggest comic like going that could be a prick and get away with it, but still be really nice.
Yeah.
I think that's even more powerful than being a dick, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, man.
It's a bit more like panicky, yeah. isn't it? If you're like, yeah. really, you should be a knob. You can get away with being an asshole.
Yeah, man. That's it. If you can get up there, and you're not far off. You're at that point where, you know, you've got there on your own terms. You haven't been a dick to anyone.
Yeah.
And that must be an amazing feeling. You know what I mean? That.
Yeah. But you never, like, I still feel like I'm a new comic coming through, but then I do bits and bobs and I go, actually, no, you're like, and it's weird because you don't want to sound like you're being flashy, but like, no, actually, you're on the telly a lot now, like,
yeah.
you're hosting yeah, your own yeah, show yeah. type thing, and you're on stuff that's on, like, it's not just like when I first started and you do like 50 greatest plastic surgery shockers, nothing yeah. wrong with doing that,
but yeah.
you can't, it's like, you sort of are on TV, but you're not on TV, yeah, and that's yeah, a yeah. weird little middle area, but I just sort of, I still just think, oh, hopefully that'll get recommended. I'm still in that same mindset, yeah, just like, well, I hope that, because, you know, it's all going well now, but like, I've got like two or three shows on the telly, which is great, but if the Channel Garvey don't want them back,
yeah.
I've got nothing.
Yeah.
I've got a tour, so I go on tour, and, you know, I'm not gonna starve, but it's very quick to go from, you're the bloke off the TV, to go, did you used to do TV?
No, yeah.
It don't take long. And the key thing, my plan is, The main thing I think with anyone doing comedy, whether you're on telly or not on telly, is just managing the plateau, because everyone's yeah. career goes zoom
yep.
at whatever level. So if you're McIntyre, vroom, to 10902,
yeah.
or if you're at a different level where you go vroom, and you do really well, you're like, oh, I've got my own Radio 4 sitcom and I sell out So Theatre for a week.
Yeah.
Amazing. Like when I first started, I just wanted to be able to get on the circuit. So you get up to there.
Yeah,
but then there'll be a point where McIntyre does 5902,
yeah.
and the person that done the Radio 4 show and the So Theatre does a week and does three nights.
Yeah.
But both McIntyre and that person have got to get their head around not being wanted as much.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
Even though that person doing the Sophia is going, what do you mean you got the unbelievable doing five nights? Like, but I'm only doing four. But there'll be someone on the circuit going, oh, what I'd give to have a Radio 4 show.
Yeah, man.
Oh, I can't believe you're moaning that you only get one, you know, and then you're like, oh, you can only do three nights at Sophia.
Yeah, it's funny, isn't it?
And then that person that's in all the clubs, there's someone below them going, yeah, but I can't even get an open mic gig now. And you get to do all the crap. So, like,
yeah,
everyone, yeah, at whatever yeah, level yeah. you're at, goes through the same feeling, because it will. It goes up and then it levels out a bit. But it's just, as long as you're okay with it, where it levels.
Yeah.
Because it's fine now, like, you know, taking pictures of the merch, you're getting picked up. It'll be an Addison Lee within a week. Which is still great. You're still getting a cab to work. It's still amazing. Don't lose sight of that. Don't sit in the Addison Lee with the hump. And that's the danger.
It's so true, man.
And then McIntyre might be at the point going, well, I haven't got my own driver now, I've got to just get a Merc. And I'm going, it's not easy when it's my own car. Yeah. But as long as you're okay with that drop off,
yeah,
and
yeah.
accept it,
keep
you know,
an eye on it. Yeah.
And people, you know, read The Secret now and go, yeah, no, if I just imagine it, it happens. Well, it won't. It might for a bit, but it will drop off.
Yeah.
You can imagine it as much as you want. Yeah, yeah. Why don't you start imagining it dropping off a bit and just make sure you're ready for it so you don't have a full mental breakdown? Because it's going to happen.
Start doing a Noel Edmonds and asking the universe.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Well, I imagined it, but I'm still in an Addison.
So that was Rob Beckett talking about the insecurities of like someone on his level, you know, he still has those insecurities. It doesn't matter where you get to. In the industry, there's always something that you're worried about, you know, like you see, you know, and you can't help it. You get caught up in it. You know, you'll see things like, you know, Michael McIntyre is doing 50 dates at wherever, and he's got a car taking him, he's got Mercedes taking him wherever, and he's like, oh, why haven't I got that? Why am I, you know? And I know that's all daft. It's daft to worry about those things. But, it doesn't matter what level you're on. There's always something that you're worried about. It just goes to show, doesn't it? We're all human beings at the end of the day. James Acaster, we had James on, and James was saying the same thing. Like, you know, he stands in front of thousands of people, there's still things that, you know, he looks like the most confident man in the world, but he's still got things that he worries about, you know. And like the age old question, like, you know, why do some of the most vulnerable people I know want to torch themselves with a career on stage? Like, why do people get up there and do it? And in people do say, they, you know, they do say, like, oh, he's so brave, he's so brave. But, you know, I think James really nailed it with this.
Everyone who tells us, I couldn't do what you do, what do you do if they don't laugh? What do you do if they heckle and all this? And we all act like for years, I was such a bullshit.
Yeah.
When they go, like, what do you do if they don't laugh? And go, that's all right, yeah, don't laugh, they don't laugh. It's up to them. What do you do if someone heckles? I just fucking deal with it. I judge it on its own individual merit, it's fine.
Yeah.
What do you do if you don't feel like being funny that day? It's my job, I've got to do it. And it's actually bollocks. all those things that people who don't do stand-up are afraid of and would worry them, and the reasons they don't do it, all of those things affect me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I'm affected by audiences not laughing.
Of course.
I'm affected by someone heckling me.
Yeah.
I'm affected by being too tired to do the gig. Like, all of it affects me.
Yeah.
And most nights I am going, yeah, I'm not superhuman. I'm exactly like everyone else in this room, except I wrote some material.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, I wrote some material, I worked on it and did gigs, but I'm exactly the same as you guys are. I'm fragile. Yeah. I can't really deal with a lot of the judgment that comes with this job.
I've never felt like I fitted in.
Yeah.
And now I'm sitting in front of you saying, no, I'm fine. But really, I'm like, oh, I just want to fit in.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It's madness. It
I
is madness.
I want to be accepted by you all.
But at the same time, I want to be in front of you.
Yeah.
Doing this to you.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Yeah. I've done that before at a gig. I remember being on stage. And suddenly I just thought about it. Mm. I just went, why are you doing this in my head? Yeah. And then suddenly the audience, like, they all sort of like felt really far away.
Mm.
And I just, oh no. Well, and then I could hear myself talking.
Yeah.
And, oh God. Oh no, I've done it. I've taken the lid off.
Yeah, yeah.
I was fine before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've had so many ones where I've articulated that on stage. And I had a gig in Brisbane, and I was, it's the most tired I've ever been before a gig. Like, I'd done 2 weeks in America where I'd been like flying to a different place every single day.
Bloody hell.
And by myself without a tour manager, and doing two shows a night that were an hour and a half each without an interval each. So it's like 3 hours of comedy a night.
Jesus.
And I've done that, and then gone straight to the Melbourne Festival and done my show every day, sometimes twice a day for 2 weeks there. Obviously, incredibly lucky to be able to do all that.
Yeah.
But by the end of those 4 weeks, I was exhausted.
Yeah.
Physically and mentally exhausted. And I needed a break. But instead, I'd book myself in this little, you know, couple of gigs in Sydney, Perth, Brisbane, before going to New Zealand. So, like, I was, I went to Brisbane. I think it was the last one of those three. So I'd done Perth, I'd done Sydney. I was already kind of like starting to come apart.
Yeah.
Because again, like, you know, your time zones start changing again.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And they don't realise how much that fucks you up.
Absolutely fucks you up. Yeah. I got to Brisbane. I remember getting to a hotel at Brisbane and just immediately, like, a few times in my life where I've just like sat down and immediately fell asleep. And then got woken up to go to the gig and was so tired, and I went on and they were just a very reserved audience.
Oh, wow.
And so, like, I didn't have any energy and they didn't have any energy.
Ugh.
And so, like, instead of just doing the gig, I kind of like started referencing, you know, they weren't laughing much. Because in Melbourne, it kind of become a part of the show.
Yes.
That I was having a go at the audience. But it's because I understand the Melbourne audience a bit more, that they're like very right on, and they like to show that they're on the right side of every issue. So if I did a routine that was a bit right on, instead of showing that they agreed with me by laughing, they would show that they agreed with me by being silent and nodding and going, yes. And so it was a funny thing throughout the show to lay into them for that. And it kind of worked with the themes of the show of like rejection and stuff like that. And me rejecting the audience and my relationship with the audience. So I thought by the time I got to Brisbane, yeah, that's part of the show now, is that you dig at the audience. Ooh. And then I had a dig at them, and they absolutely were like not having any of it, and were like really surprised and being like, oh, well, we thought we were laughing, we thought we liked this show. And then eventually it was like, so it was like they're not laughing at the show very loud, they're laughing at this stuff even less, and now I've got nothing. And so I kind of like at one point kind of completely just became a normal person on stage and went, okay, well, look, I was only doing all that stuff, having a go at you, because normally that's my plan B.
Oh, wow.
And
deconstructing the deconstruction.
Like, I was only doing that to try, but that's not working, so I don't really know where I'll go from here. I'm fucking knackered. And I kind of shared too much with them, like really told them about just why it wasn't going. I was like, okay, well, this is fucked, and guess it's pretty awkward now, and I don't really know how to get out of this and all this. And then, like, people were concerned afterwards. Like, people were contacting my dad on Twitter, saying, like, really worried about your son. People contacted Stuart Goldsmith on the Comedians Comedian Facebook group, saying, you want to check in on him. A Reddit thread started about the one gig, just being like, you know, who was at that gig the other night? You know, who else is concerned about it? And really, it was just that I was absolutely exhausted and shouldn't have been doing a gig. I should have been having a day off. That was all it was. But you know, my job involves having to talk for an hour.
Yes.
Some people, if they're feeling like that at work, can just get their head down, sit behind their desk. Okay, I just won't do much work today, but I don't have to speak to people out loud about what's going on in my head all the time.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, I'm having to try and make them laugh, and sometimes part of making them laugh is being real with them and going, well, if I go this way, I might find an observation that we all relate to, and then you don't. And you feel even more alienated, like, oh, I'm the only person who feels like this, so I'm a weirdo now, and they all think I'm weird. And then you get defensive.
Yeah.
But, like, what I realised about, I was in a therapy session the other day, and I was talking about, like, needing approval as a kid and needing a, like, you know, validation from adults as a kid. And I remembered that there was this... this video of myself, home video, and there's some family friends are over called Julian and Karen, a couple who are friends with my parents. And there's a video of me going over and showing this drawing that I've done. I used to do loads of drawings as a kid and showing it to this guy, Julian, and being like that. And he was like, oh, that's so good. Wow, James, that's really clever. And me just like looking up at him, like really like, feeding off of it. He likes the drawing. I don't even think so. And like all this. And in Brisbane, they were at that gig. That couple had moved to Australia, and I hadn't seen them since I was a kid. And they had contacted me and been like, can we come and see you tonight? And I got them tickets. And then on stage, all I was thinking was, they're not like those two. I didn't put it together in my head until I was talking in the therapy session. He was like, is there any, like, because we're talking about needing validation as a kid and showing adults like drawings or putting plays on and all that. And I remembered that video. I was like, oh, fuck, that was him. And they were in my childhood I definitely did that with all the time. Like every time they came over, I would have showed them drawings going, this is good. Do you think this is good?
And
then I'm an adult and they're coming to see me do stand-up for the first time. They haven't seen me since I was in primary school. and I'm like, want to show them that it's great. And then when it goes badly, for some reason I go into this deeper pit of despair than I usually would. And I don't know why at the time. And then now I'm like, because
of that.
Because that's who they are
for
you.
They're
these people that you want them to give you a pat on the head and go, well done, James, we're proud of you, you're doing well. and now you fucked it. Like on stage, like they're not going to say this to you now. You've completely, they're going to think that you're not on the right track with comedy. And,
But you've done so many good things and had so many good gigs and have been so successful that things like that now probably you're able to go, oh, like you've just said, I just needed a night off.
Yeah.
Where at the time it's probably more intense than that, but now you can sort of look back and go, I haven't fucked my career.
Mm.
I just got to take some time out when I get like that. I've learned a valuable lesson.
I'm able to give myself to know to deal with it. And having a year off next year.
Yeah.
Which might become 2 years off. I'm not putting any kind of time limit on it.
So there you go. So even someone on James Acaster's level, it's like we said, there's still things to worry about. You know, it's a funny one with stand-up. I mean, I am shy. Fundamentally, I'm a shy person. Yet, I'm at my happiest when I'm stood in front of people making them laugh. It's a strange one that you can never really explain. Mark Steele was on, and Mark was like, why do we do stand-up? But actually, perhaps Mark can answer those questions.
I suppose once you start doing your own shows, it takes a while to adjust.
Yeah, it does. It definitely does. It definitely does. I've managed to reduce one bit of stress every lot from that. And now there's only 900,000 other sources of stress to just deal with.
Yeah.
I don't know. I would take all the psychologists of the world to deal with all my issues. Like the Oppenheimer project where they got all the scientists in America and they got them all together to try and make the nuclear bomb. That's what they need to do. Working. No, faster, come on. The guy's crazy, come on. We've only had 2 years.
We need to find out what makes him tick, come on.
I don't think I'll ever suss it out. The fact that we get up and do what we do.
Mental.
It is mad, isn't it?
It's mental. And I haven't sort of done my own show for about 3 months. And that's disastrous. Because I've got, as we sit here now, I've got in 2 days time doing the Acme Empire.
Nice.
And the trouble is, I'm thinking, what am I doing? So if you keep doing it, it's all right. Probably like being a serial killer. As long as you keep going, you're all right. If you stop for 6 months, you think, what am I doing sawing people's heads off and putting them in the fridge? But if you keep going,
you don't think, you haven't got time to think about it, have you?
You haven't got time to reflect. And now I'm thinking, what am I doing? How many people? What, the ticket? They're more mad than I am. What?
Oh. It's nice though, you're in a position where people are coming to you to see
yeah,
you.
Yeah, well then, that's, even lovely, that's relative though, isn't it? Because, you know, you're always in a flap in this job. I'm sure that when people are selling out, I'm sure, I don't know, one day Kevin Bridges will only sell out 15 nights instead of 20 nights at an arena. And he'll be going, oh, that's
shit, I'm done, I'm over.
Oh, I'm fucking finished. got 25 minutes to sell out the fucking 15th night. But so it's always it's all relative, isn't it? You know, so I know it's ridiculous because you think, oh, why haven't he? Oh, last year I sold that many tickets, and now it's gone down by 35.
But that's not. I don't think that's a personal thing. I think that's just the state of things at the minute, isn't it? People are more reluctant to go out, maybe.
Yeah, I don't know. But there's always reason. But that's the terrible thing when if you've not sold tickets somewhere, then that someone will try to make excuse for it. It's because it's a Saturday, people in Nottingham never come out on Saturdays, and also it is the fifth round of Strictly Come Dancing, which is always a difficult night.
Yeah, there's always something.
And it is sort of quite mild, and the people in this town don't like mild weather. And, and they've got a new one-way system on the far end of town, and that's probably it. And that is something that really... I think that probably is one of the reasons, not the main one, but I think that is one of the reasons why comics go a little bit doolally, is because... That is, there really is no hiding from the fact. If people don't come to your show anymore, or even if it goes down 10%, well, then it might be because there's a recession or something that might account for some of it. But really, it's a reflection of you're not as popular as you were last year. And conversely, you know, when it goes up, oh, this is good. And there isn't really a lot of hiding from that. And you can blame it on publicity and the poster was no good or whatever, but... It is sort of, and it's you, isn't it? Which is what actors don't have. They might go, oh, this play was just shite, you know, and it was just a bad choice that I was in that play, or I was in a, you know, brilliant actors are in films that are just rubbish and nobody goes. It's not a reflection on them, but with us,
it's just us.
If people don't come, or if it doesn't go down very well or something, it's you. Yeah. It's like they're going, no, it's not your act, mate. It's you.
You personally, you. Just you. If it was someone else saying the words, much better. But it's you.
It will cunt, to be honest, mate.
And as you know, he's not that much of a cunt. It's funny, actually, the word, that C word, it comes up quite a bit sometimes. I do try to edit it out. We do get a bit carried away now and again. But then Mark, you know, brings us nicely onto another recurring subject, which is our parents.
Oh, I used to get so drunk, and it was just, I was a terrible mess, really.
Yeah, same.
And then I hated being at home, and I didn't get on with my dad was in an asylum by then.
Bloody hell.
First of all, I suppose we ought to talk about that, shouldn't we?
Is that?
Given the premise of the podcast. But my dad by then was in this home.
Right, and these were your adopted parents?
So I was adopted at a very young age. So they were my mum and dad. That's all I ever knew, was them being my mum and dad.
Yeah.
And then my dad, I don't know. I think he would be called manic depressive if he was around today, or bipolar, sorry.
Yeah.
That's out of date, isn't it? So he'd be called bipolar, I think, because he would have periods where he was really almost like a coke addict.
Yeah,
he'd be like...
Right, yeah.
And then he'd have, and because he was the insurance man, right? So that was his job. He'd go around, knock on the doors, and he'd be all, you know, hello, Elsie, hello, love. All right, how you doing? How's the old man? All right, is his back all right? There you go, darling. See you next week, 1 and 6. Yeah, that was his job. And then if he sold any bits of insurance, then he got a little bit of commission on that.
Right.
So there'd be like, and he would make a few bob, and then he'd just blow it on shite, you know, which is a very up in the bipolary sort of thing to do, I gather. So I remember one day, but I used to like, you know, he'd take me out and stuff. So there'd be days, I remember one day he went, look, right, now, here, watch what I'll do here, right? Smart. And so there was a thing in the local paper that there was a big sale, everything must go, up in Westminster. So very exciting. We went into London, right. Which, you know, like you...
Like we said earlier, yeah.
Yeah, that was a rare thing. And I went with my dad, we went into London, and we went to this... It was just a great big market stall in this big hall with a bloke stood there with all this sort of 70s... shite, you know. There you go, look at this, there you go, electric toothbrush, look at these, you've seen these on the telly, you thought you'd never have one, didn't you, missus? There's all this, but it was much bigger than a mug, there were hundreds of people there. I'll tell you what, I've got six of them in a pack, they're £35 or whatever, it wouldn't be that much, would it? Well, I don't know, they're £5 each. I'm not going to ask £5 each, I'm not going to ask four, three, two, all this.
£5, yeah,
you can have the lot, stick your hands up, they've been on the telly, police, five, I'm only joking. Come on, four they all go. There you go, Kent White, lady down there, all that. And my old man, I remember, my old man just bought the fucking lot and we loaded up the car with electric carving knives and all the old shit that used to be on the conveyor at the end of the generation. And we'd have all fucking an electric butter dish or something. And we got the fucking, there you are, see? And he go, there you go, son, she's smart, you know, that's what you're, if you're the smart person, see what I've done, I've gone up here and I've bought, and I thought, this is all shit. And we got it, we went in the loft and it stayed there till fucking dad died.
That was it.
Mum moved out. It was just completely rubbish.
And we don't just talk about our parents. I mean, we could talk about that all day, couldn't we? God bless them. But, you know, we also talk about being parents. And David Bidio had a great story for us.
There's a weird parents thing of like what happened to the thing that I was looking after, you know, and I still, you know, he's still young enough that I feel I am sort of looking after him. I don't know whether that would be true anymore. He wouldn't think so, but I sort of am. I'm going to tell another story.
Go on.
I'm
going to
tell
a story now.
I told this on stage the other day and I thought this one get a laugh and I don't even know if I should tell it. And I told it and it got a massive laugh.
Okay.
So I got approached by a paedophile when I was 11 on the tube, 11 or 12. Mm. And that's because my parents not being particularly good parents, they just let me go just on the tube in the 70s. And I used to go to Hamleys, right? The
when
toy
you were
shop.
11?
Yeah, Hamleys, by myself to look at toys I couldn't afford.
Wow.
I used to do that a lot, just go and look at them, right? How sad and bleak is that? Anyway, so I was telling Ezra this story and I just sort of, wasn't really as a stranger danger thing or whatever, but it was just like, I just thought I'll share this with him. And so I was told him the whole story. I was on the tube, I was a young kid, and it's very horrible this, and a man sits down next to me, I can still remember, he smelled awful and whatever, crowded tube, sits down next to me and says, oh, are you with your parents? And I say no, and he starts immediately, as he's whispering in my ear, just asking me stuff about my private parts, and about whether I ever think about girl, but I've got any pubic hair, you know. And it's a very horrible thing. Yeah. I'm really frightened. I remember I went and hid in the next carriage and he sort of followed me and it was all really horrible, right? So I was all right. I wasn't abused anyway. It was just like really horrible experience. Anyway, I told that story to Ezra and he said, did you see anything nice in Hamleys? Anyway, it got a massive laugh and I was so pleased about it because when he did it, I laughed and laughed and laughed and thought, that is the first time I feel I've told that story and felt a great weight lift from me from someone's reaction to it.
I mean, what a great story that was. That's the other thing as well. There've been some great laughs as well. We're talking about some quite serious subjects now sometimes, but we're able to do it. You sort of see the funny side in a lot of it. And that story was no exception. Funny. It was, and again, it was a bit surreal having David Bedil on, you know. I tell you, speaking of surreal, we had Romish. So Romish came on. And that was early. That was early in the lockdown. And I've been trying to get Romish for ages. And then obviously we all got locked down. And we were like, all right, now's the perfect time to do it. So Romish came on. And he really opened up. Again, he talked about his dad and the tricky sort of relationship he had with his dad and how his mum now... You know, later, now his mum's really smashing it. Like she's on the TV and she's having a great time, having a great life. You know, it was really nice. You know, so he talked about that. He talked about his childhood. There's again a really great conversation.
My dad was obviously pissed off. He'd seen me like coming in whenever I felt like it and just being a bit of a twat. He picked me up on it. And I turned around and I absolutely like unloaded on him. Do you know what I mean? Just like, you've never been here. You fucked off and did this, that, and the other. And then you come back here and you think you can tell me, you know, really horrible.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
Shit that if one of my kids said that to me, I would be devastated. Do you know what I mean? If I, and so I remember having that, having that go at him, and then I left, like walked out of the house or whatever, and yeah. they just let me go because obviously thought I was like, I'd lost my shit or whatever. And yeah, then yeah. we never mentioned that conversation again. And then as time went on, my dad and I made up and we became very, very close again. And when by the time my dad passed away, we had a very good relationship. But the thing is, after he passed away, I still thought about that conversation and I cried about it as one of the things that I regretted saying to him.
Oh, really?
Even despite the fact that we'd made amends and, you know, we were very, very close. And I think I just thank God that he hadn't passed away when that was still, do you know what I mean? If I had not made things up with him, I would have been so, I don't know what that would have done to me. Do you know what I mean? It was like,
oh mate. It's funny, isn't it? Cause it was like, judging by what you've just said and then where that feeling came from, I mean, it was justified, but you still felt guilty.
Well, it's just because it's because I don't know. You can't help thinking, you know, I don't know why my dad made the decisions he did. And I don't know what pressures he was under. I don't know what he was going through, any of those things. And I'm not saying that justifies how he behaved at all.
No.
But I think that regardless of what he did, the way that I spoke, I mean, it was brutal. Do you know what I mean? It's probably the most brutal thing I've ever said to anybody. Do you know what I mean? That monologue to him. Mm, and I, wow, and man. You know, so I think, regardless of what he did, in my heart, I feel like he didn't really deserve to hear that.
Yeah. I remember doing a similar thing with my dad, and I saw it was a moment where there was the power dynamic changed between us.
Right.
When I'd split up with the mum of my kids, I was living back there for a bit, and he came in, and I was sat in his chair, and I was on the phone.
Yeah.
It's about 20 years ago now. And he came in from work and he looked at me and he's like, and he mouthed like, "You're in my chair." And I lost my shit. And
right.
I just went, you're in your fucking chair. And I threw the chair across the room.
Yeah.
And I really lost my shit because I was going through this other stuff.
Yeah.
And all that sort of thing. And then I stood up and he went to go for me. And he goes, "I'm not having this." And I went, "Yeah, we're going to fucking do." And he flinched. And at first, I cried my eyes out because I saw he went from being my dad to this like little man. And I went out and I remember driving my car off 1,000 miles an hour, driving off, just crying. I couldn't control myself.
Yeah.
And I was just heartbroken and went back afterwards and said to him, "Dad, listen, regardless of anything, I should never, ever talk to you in that way. That's yeah. Like you've just said, regardless of anything that's gone before, you're my dad and you never, I should have more respect."
Yeah.
"And I'm sorry." Yeah. So I get it, man.
You're so mad with the parent thing. I mean, this is a much more, lighter example than the one you just gave, but like, I'm not saying, I don't want to trivialize what you just said, but like, I remember the first, my mum used to like hit us a fair bit, right? Like not hard, but she used to give us, you know, Sri Lankan upbringing, do you know what I mean? Anyway,
I that was the same with us as well. My mum's got some Sri Lankan.
Yeah, maybe, yeah. She's got some cultural influences or something. But I remember the first time my mum was chasing me around the bedroom and because the bedroom was like, was messy and she tripped over and fell down. And I remember thinking, shit, I didn't know mum could fall down. I didn't know she could trip over. Like the cycle, I just thought my parents were so perfect. I didn't see them as people. Do you know what I mean? You see them as these infallible beings that always get everything right and their judgment is impeccable and all that. You go through that. As a kid, that's what you believe. And then obviously, as you get older, you realise that they're just regular people. Do you know what I mean? They make mistakes and stuff like that. But it's such a weird thing, isn't it? Those little changes in your perception of your parents are so mad.
Oh, mate. Yeah, like you say, they go from being your parents that know everything to being human beings that are just trying to get by themselves. Yeah. They're still working it out.
The one thing that I think I feel the most happy about is my mum. Is my mum getting her being on TV or her enjoying the success and all that kind of stuff. I think that, I went through, I mean, I reckon I went through 2 years of staying in a bed and breakfast. My mum, my brother and I were in the same room, maybe 18 months. And I reckon my mum cried herself to sleep 80 to 90% of those nights.
And
so, like, you sort of think about that. I mean, you think now I think to myself, well, my mum's doing this, that, and the other. Like, she's so happy in how things turned. Do you know what I mean? She's so happy for that. And I think to myself, well, fucking hell, that is an amazing thing.
So it was a real pleasure to have Romesh on and talking about his experiences. And, you know, like I keep saying, it's been a real eye-opener doing these interviews. And it's taught me a lot. It's taught me a lot about how I interact with people. And certainly doing this as hosting a podcast, I actually do care. I care about the guests that are on. It's all about the guests. I care about the people listening. You know, this isn't just a platform for me to just like show off. I actually do want to do my bit for people and their mental health. And this one, Ishan Akbar came on. And again, I've worked with Ishan loads, and we'd had a kind of conversation before in the car on the way to comedy shows and things like that. But we haven't really got stuck in. But this one, he came in. And it was very, disarming is the word. I don't know. He was so open about what was going on that day, and the things like he opened up about his attempted suicide, but the way it was done, it was like we did it in a way. It just kind of naturally just tumbled out of us in this wonderful, loving, fun sort of way. You know, it was a nice thing. And Ishan came on and he talked about his mum on a very, very important day for him.
How are you feeling?
I'm feeling all right. It's the fifth anniversary of the day my mum passed away.
Yeah.
And so this morning I kind of left the house and I was fine at home.
Mm.
And then I just started crying on
Mate.
On the train. Mm. And it's interesting because when you're a bloke that cries on the train, other people don't actually know what to do.
No.
So there's no tissues being offered, no hug, no sandwich.
And then people look at going, I wonder what he's done.
Yeah. And basically, because I was wearing a hoodie and had a rucksack, they were probably thinking, oh, it's a final journey for him, isn't it?
Oh, my God.
Move away.
Everyone's moving away.
Yeah, to a different carriage. Like, that's going to save you.
Oh, God. And your name's Akbar. Just saying your name over and over again.
I wonder if suicide bombers do cry before. It must be terrifying.
There must be a moment.
What am I doing? I'm going to lose everything now.
Because they get sewn into the vest as well. They can't take them off.
Yeah, they can't. Yeah.
So if you change your mind,
you're buggered.
Yeah. Do they sew it into your clothes or just sew it into your body? I don't know. Don't know why I'm asking you. That's massively racist. Just assume
from,
you
from
know.
The newsletter.
So tell me about the suicide bombers.
From the newsletter I get every month, Rich, it's so,
Bombers Monthly.
So to your clothes. What weird diversion this is taking.
They just get it tucked into the Quran.
Yeah.
Like with a new shopper.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
That's funny. Anyway.
Sorry, dude.
So today was the day.
Why?
I'm so glad it came. You just,
if I,
good
yeah,
release.
Just get it off. Yeah, listen, if anyone's listening, I'm really sorry.
This is always how our conversations end up at some point though, Rich.
I think this is, you and I hit it off straight away when we first met.
Yeah, you looked really dapper.
And you're just one of those people, I think, that just, you're just very open and honest and inviting.
Yeah.
And we just straight away
hit it off.
Yeah. And I remember being in the cars going, this is a beautiful man.
Yeah. Thank you. I felt the same about you.
Just straight away. And then you were telling me that wonderful story about your mum and the ceremony that surrounded what happened when she passed on. And it was one of the most beautiful stories I've ever heard.
Yeah. I mean, my mum passing was still to this day something I reel from.
Of course. I don't think you ever get over it.
You don't. And I think particularly because we're talking about mental health as well, is this one thing I don't think people talk about enough, my girlfriend actually put me wise to this, is that we don't talk enough about the triggers that lead to people having mental health issues for a certain period of time.
Yeah.
So the way I felt since my mum died, after that I was with a horrible woman who cheated on me 3 times.
What?
And I let her, basically, because I was just like so bereft of self-confidence.
You just felt, I deserve anything better.
Yeah, it's not going to get any better than this, and this is better than nothing.
Yeah, right.
So I had a string of quite bad relationships. in November last, well, where are we now, 2019? November 2017, I tried to jump in front of a train.
What?
Because it was just a culmination of so much, you know, my mum, my relationships, the general feeling as a bloke of you thinking, you know, I left a banking career to do this job. I've not done enough for my parents. I've not done this, you know. And my whole thing has been, I don't talk to anyone.
No.
I never did. I never talked to my mates.
Yeah, right. It's quite solitary what we do.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
It's a very solitary job. And particularly because I had just started my career then. I was driving to kind of fuck but nowhere by myself, having time to think and ruminate about all the things that I didn't do with my life. And talking to my friends was... It was never really an option that I've ever considered.
Yeah.
Only because I'm the fun guy.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't want to bother people with my problems.
And how do you start the conversation? How do you... That's the main problem that a lot of people find is... How do you say to your mate... When every time... You have certain relationships with certain people.
Yeah.
And every time you see that person, there's a level that you're always on.
Yeah.
Like... Banter, if you will.
Yeah, yeah.
And how do you come out of that and go, do you know what, actually, I'm not feeling great.
Yeah.
And I'm teetering on the edge here of doing something really daft. That's the difficult bit. But you felt you could.
Well, I, at the time, you know, in November 2017, when...
So did you go to actually do it?
Yeah, yeah. So what happened is I was basically fine. For a couple of weeks, I was fine.
Yeah.
I felt a lot better. And that morning, I was on my way into work, and I got to Stratford Station. And for some reason, this thought just came into my head that, oh, the way you solve your problems
is by... Take yourself out.
Take yourself out. And it was a Central Line train. A train was coming in. And I went to jump, and I distinctly remember this. I went to jump, and I hesitated because I remembered I had a meeting at 10:30 at work. Like, it was as minor as that. It wasn't, I'm going to miss my brother, I'm going to miss whatever.
You went, oh, shit,
I've got a meeting.
Oh, bollocks, yeah, I've got things to do.
So as I went to jump, I hesitated and the train kind of hit my back and I rolled back onto the platform.
You were that close?
Yeah, yeah. Like, it was, I mean, inches.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Fuck.
Rolled onto the platform.
Did anyone see you?
Yeah, because it was a busy platform. One person, a woman was like, oh, he's been hit by a train. Another bloke was like, no, I think he jumped. At that point, I just got up and just belted it out of the station.
Yeah, right, okay. Went
to the Pret outside Stratford Station, got myself a coffee, and then went into work and did the gig that night.
Did you feel, having been that close to doing it, and then did you feel, then you went, actually, I don't actually want to do that? Or you just went, I'll get the meeting out of the way and I'll do it on my own? I'll do it later.
Well, the doing it again didn't really enter my mind. It was just that moment felt so clear. And after that, I was just like, well, I mean, it happened and it was kind of like an out-of-body experience. I'm just going to get on with it.
Yeah, right.
And I didn't talk to anyone. And it took about maybe 3 months before I told anybody.
Holy shit. That's massive.
Well, yeah, I mean, I guess people might be thinking, well, he's talking quite casually about it now. But I think... If you speak to anyone who's ever attempted something like that, we do get quite casual about it because it's something that isn't outside the realms of possibility.
No.
And so it's easier for us to just talk about it. You know, I can talk to you very openly about my mum's death. What I feel about it, I'd probably struggle with.
Yeah, right.
Yeah. I can tell you everything that happened, the burial, me going into the grave, lowering her to rest, all that. The superficial stuff I can talk about, but like facing up to the feelings, even, you know, just now, what I felt about trying to do that to myself in November, I just...
It's just now a part of you, it's just a story that you tell.
A story I have.
Yeah.
So even that's, you know, that conversation for me made me realise that suicidal thoughts are kind of, they're more prevalent than we realise, and just because you might have them, it doesn't mean there's anything wrong. It's just there's something, you know, you just, you know, something else in your life is hurting and you want it to stop and you don't, you know, you don't really know how to deal with it. And that's what I gained from that. It kind of, that chat of Ishan really opened my eyes
to that, and it was a real, I just, even now I think about it, I'm like, that's quite a pivotal moment throughout this, you know, in this podcast. And I mean, another pivotal moment is when Dane Baptiste came down. We'll return to parents in a bit, but at the end of this episode, and for one of my most favourite interviews of the whole series. But first, Dane came down. Dane is one of the most intelligent people I've ever met, and he knew what he wanted to say. He knew how he wanted to say it, and he came in and he sat down, and after a couple of pleasantries and a couple of bottles of water, off he went, and it was something else. We talked about we got onto the subject of men's relationship with women on a broader level, and he explained so much about this, and it was so. At one point, producer Paul and I just looked at each other and go, like, fuck, this is incredible. It was so to the point and succinct, and all the details were in there. Nobody put it more succinctly than Dane Baptiste.
Because obviously on this podcast, you were talking about like men and men with mental health. Yeah. And in some ways that can always exist as a schism to women's health. And, you know, obviously people talking about men's issues because, like I said, we've not had the opportunity to increase or work on developing emotional intelligence.
That's it.
And it's crazy because it's like the paradox that is required for you to know you come from a woman and then have some say in how they should be controlled.
I know.
That paradox, look, you are always going to be fucked in your head.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because it's like whoever a man is, I don't care how tall, how strong, every man on this planet has cried for a woman.
Yeah, right.
So for patriarchy to even exist, it's probably the biggest paradox that men are dealing with in terms of their mental health, is that you are born in reverence to a woman.
Yeah.
And at the behest of one.
That's it, yeah.
So now this supposition that they are trying to usurp us or take power from you.
Yeah, man.
It's insane.
Yeah, of course
and it's a duality that will fuck you forever.
Yeah.
Because you're going to live in constant fear that you're going to be, really, you feel, because a woman really is a reflection of your helplessness. And really nothing will undercut the image or the narrative of masculinity than a woman.
Yeah.
Because like I said, it doesn't matter. Strongest man in the world, you cried your fucking eyes out when you were born.
True, man.
Because you needed a woman to take care of you.
Because
a man couldn't do it. Because you nurse from a woman, that's who they cut the cord from. That's how you'll survive. How she however she conducts herself will determine the manner in which she comes into this world.
Yeah.
So this idea that losing ground to matriarchy, if they wanted us dead, you'd be fucking dead. Simply put, if they wanted us dead, we'd be fucking dead.
True.
So it's like, again, for you to like be like, oh, I'm a Darwinist, but then women have lower rates of mortality in infancy. They're more likely to survive. They are the reason we're able to continue as a species. So there is no interest, be it political or social, for women to suppress men.
No.
Because we need them to survive.
That's right.
And they create us in order for us to survive.
Yeah.
That is an instinct they've had way before you were even any kind of field of study regarding gender. It's the instinct they've always had.
Yeah, man.
Rain, shine, sleet, snow, hail. The reason we're still fucking here is that in the midst of war and famine, women are still like,
women,
I still have to bring my fucking offspring into this world.
That's right, man. Yeah.
So,
you've nailed it, man.
And that's the big part of men and our paradox and what we struggle with is this fact that like, We feel we have to create all these ideas. Like at the end of the evolutionary train of Homo sapiens, it's like a European man with a spear. The definition of species is an organism that can mate with another organism and produce viable offspring. And that just basically means like a lion and tiger can mate, but normally the offspring will be infertile.
Mm.
So that's why lions and lionesses mate. Right, so that's different species. So human beings, we're all Homo sapiens. And there's been a lot of pseudoscience created to say that we're different, whether it's like phrenology and strands or shapes of our heads. And we talk about breeds more than mating, because that's the problem. Like in Europe, we breed more than we mate. So it's like this person's from this stock and they're from this class and we focus on this but we're all Homo sapien and it doesn't affect us at all. So we've kind of fucked ourselves in that respect. But because of the fact that you need to define a species, you need a member of that species to be able to pass its genes on. Only women can do that.
Yeah.
So why a woman isn't at the end of the evolutionary chain is the beginning of where our problems begin.
Yes, women. We'd be nowhere without them. I tell you what, I genuinely say that. I say that with my hand on my heart. I wouldn't be the man I am today without the women that have been in my life. Women just sort shit out. They're just in charge, aren't they? I don't know why men fight it. Just accept it, you know? You know, we'd be nowhere without them. But how much did I really understand them?
Not at all, it turns out. According to my partner, Jade Adams, I don't know as much about women as I thought I did. So, you know, we thought, right. So in June 2020, we launched a spin-off show, Insane in the Fembrain, where I talk to women about what it's like to be a woman. Because well, no, I don't know, do I? And we really got stuck in. And it was, again, it's been truly enlightening. One of our first guests that month was Eleanor Tiernan, who I've worked with many times before. Fantastic comic. And she chose our chat to make a little announcement. We spoke a couple of weeks ago, and you said... news sounds a bit shit. You have news.
I know, and it is weird. It's kind of the way I was telling my friends that this thing that has been happening for me a few weeks ago, and the way I introduced it to them was I said I have a bit of gossip, and then I said,
did you look over your shoulder first, like, look around, see if anyone was looking?
Well, that's the great thing about gossip, about this particular piece of gossip, because it's about myself. So we don't need to feel bad about sharing it. Yeah. So yeah, I came out in February. I think there's no exact moment when it happened, but I feel like that's the time that it happened. I started going through that process of owning the fact that I'm gay. And sharing with and including people in my life, and living my life as a lesbian, and it's been great.
How do you feel?
So I feel I feel more grown up, and I feel more alert, and I feel more able. And I feel more, I feel braver, and I feel like I have more of myself now for the rest of the world, and more. I think I can pay better attention to the world now that I haven't got this little, I guess, whack-a-mole thing inside of me that I have to just keep trying to shut up, which is kind of what being in the closet is like. Like, I was, this is going to sound too much like material, but what I've been feeling is like, you know, in your laptop, you keep getting asked to download an upgrade, and you keep going, fuck off with the upgrade. I don't, that was like what being in the closet was like. It's like coming out was the upgrade, and I was like, no, I don't want to do it. I don't want to do it.
Fuck my laptop.
Yeah, exactly. I'm fine how I am. This is the old system works really well. When you have that going on, a lot of it is unconscious, but you put an enormous amount of energy, emotional energy, intellectual energy, and a lot of physical energy as well into curtailing protecting a certain secret that you have, and you're trying not to protect yourself by doing that, but it's ultimately it's like putting a weight on a structure that it can't hold, or it's not designed to hold.
You can feel it buckling.
Yeah, you can. Yeah. And I guess I didn't get to a point where there was a complete collapse, but it was I could see it coming, and I was trying to, okay, well, you know, trying to do the smart thing here. You know, I can wait for that to happen, or I can just do it now save myself the hassle. And I mean, there's lots of hassle I didn't save myself. You know, I could have done this a lot sooner in my life, because it's not like a lot of women or people come out when they come out later in life. It's like, oh, this is something I just realized. I'm in a new relationship now, and it's great. Well, this is definitely something that I kind of knew about myself from my early 20s, and just wasn't in a place where I felt confident enough to share it, and hopeful enough that I could expect a good reaction from people.
Were you projecting? You were assuming that they wouldn't take it well, or
I mean, from the reaction I've gotten now, that Rich, this is going to seem so daft, because like when I told my parents about this back in March, they were like enthusiastic about it, like not accepting. Like they were like, okay, you know, you got to get out, you got to tell your other brothers.
Yeah, right.
You know, we want to tell our friends, and we can't do that until you have all your boxes ticked. Yeah. So I was like, okay, whoa, everybody.
Hang on.
Yeah. I'm the gay one here.
Yeah, you're taking away my moment, for fuck's sake.
Yeah. If I want to milk it, I'll milk it, okay? but yeah, the support I have in my life, and I'm very lucky, is great. So now I kind of have to look back and go, what the hell was I doing? Why did I wait so long? And because because I think more of it is down to me than I was initially assuming. And I think the short version of what happened, I think, is possibly when I was quite young. I was, you know, had a bullying experience in school, I became very alert to not giving anybody information that could be used against me. And I guess the world I was living in at the time, which coupled with that, I didn't see lesbians in the world being hugely celebrated.
I'm not going to admit to that. Yeah.
You know, it just seemed like a way to kind of, you know, help people who wanted, you know, to harm me. And I was like, you know, I'm no idiot. I'm not going to do that.
Why would I do that? Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I waited a good 20 years to see if that was.
Just to make sure.
I know, to make sure. And I think so far so good, basically.
And it's here and there. What a privilege to have her come on the show and do that and to announce something so important in her life, you know. And the press loved her coming out on our podcast. There was a lot of messages we got. And, you know, it was a really beautiful moment, a really beautiful thing to be a part of. Something I've never experienced before. It was a wonderful thing. And then it seemed like like she'd pushed open the floodgates. And because exactly 1 week later, I was talking to Jess Fostercue about similar experiences. You've recently come out. Is it recently?
Yeah. In the last year. I was really nervous, but I just sort of made a deal with myself. And if I'm honest, with my shrink, about like, it had got to the point where, because I'm good mates with both my parents, and it was starting to feel duplicitous that I was talking about it so freely in my friendship groups and in my work that I hadn't said anything, you know, to them. And
yes.
I was like, so I was like, right, well, when there's a natural opportunity for it, I'll have those conversations. And then it'd come up and I told my mum, and that's another story in itself. But she'd said, well, you know, I don't think you need to tell. She was a bit, you know, one of the not perfect things she said was, I don't think you necessarily need to tell your stepdad or your dad. And I was like, I think I do. I think I probably do. what am I going to just, shall I just introduce them to my girlfriend and just sit, just curveball it like that? Jesus. So anyway, I was
say nothing at all. Yeah.
What?
just be sat there with a cup of tea.
Yeah.
Like nothing.
I've not told this story to many people at all. I was just having a coffee with my dad in his little flat, and he was talking about. I was saying that my ex and me had banned a particular TV show that our kid had been watching, because he reenacts bits of certain shows, and there's been one or two shows that he's watched a few of and then just been really violent for a couple of weeks, and he's acting out this. It's called Dino King, if anyone wants to steer clear of it on Netflix. And he'd just been he sort of acts it out, and but it gets really wound up while he's doing it. So anyway, I was saying that to Dad, and Dad said, oh well, when his next batch of kids were little, one his son James had mates, two boys, who were never allowed to watch anything. They were never allowed to watch any even slightly violent telly or films. They weren't even allowed fizzy drinks. And I was like, oh, right. And he went, well, what's really funny about it is that one of them's grown up to be the biggest drug dealer in, I'll say, insert town in Hampshire. And he went, and the other one's a bender. And I was like, oh, God. And I sat there and I was like, well, do you know what, Dad? Mate, this is so eggy. Even me laying, I was like, funny you should say that, because I'm at least half a bender, Dad. And just sort of put it in his own language. And he was like, all right.
Wow.
He was just like, oh, all right. Like that. And he smirked, the smirk on his face. He just was tickled. It's one of those funny things where my mum told me that when I was about 11, I think it's not a coincidence that's when my parents were breaking up, but my God, they definitely needed to break up. That was a rough old year for lots and lots of reasons. And I had I stopped eating and stuff, and I just had a rough old year. And my dad, apparently in one of their few discussions about it with my mum, had said, I think maybe she's a lesbian. Which is really funny, I think, right. Because actually I don't think I was. Like, I don't have any recollections of any crushes. I never had crushes on girls at school. Like, I was so into boys. And I've had loads of... So I don't know what to identify as, really. Something changed rather than me. I'm not one of those people that knew when they were a tiny kid that they were queer at all. I'm not saying I wasn't, like, on a spectrum, but I never had any dalliances. Like, the odd kiss off my nuts on recreationals.
But who hasn't done that?
Do you know what I mean? That's just that's just having a nice open mind. I didn't fall for anyone. There weren't I genuinely was someone who would be like, well, I think she's very good looking, that person, and you know, but I didn't want to get in people's pants. Something fundamentally changed. And so he was wrong then as well. But I think that's why the smirks spread across his face, because he probably thought, oh, right, always knew that or something. Oh, I don't know. But he's just, and then he's been, you know, he's been quite honest about, he's told, you know, various family members and stuff who've not taken to it well. I couldn't give a shit though. Do you know what I mean? That's the joy of coming out in your mid 30s. Because I think if you have to endure that when you're a kid or a teenager and every fibre of your self-worth, because you don't really know who you are yet, depends on what your loved ones think of you and how much they respect you. Whereas when you're 36, it's just like, well, I couldn't give a shit what Uncle Jim thinks. Apparently, I have an uncle whose name isn't really Jim, but who said, oh God, we've already got one of those in the family. Because his brother's gay. It's disowned brother's gay. Yeah, it's madness. But it's one of those funny things where I think if you talk to people who've had a lifetime of being oppressed for their queerness, they're quite sad about my coming out story to my dad. Whereas in the context of knowing my dad and knowing that I am new to this tiny drop in privilege so far, I have a lot to learn, that actually this was fine. Like, there is no hatred. There's no drop in respect. He's not going to change the way he'll be like lovely to my girlfriend. Like, he's sound. Like, he just needed to, it's how he copes with stuff, is to get angry or laugh. That's what he does. Yeah. That's his range. That's his pair of emotions. And
your pair of emotions.
And he chose laughter. I had a lovely story actually, because he's been so jolly and he's had questions and stuff, and he's very positive, but there's this little naughty little smirk. I think he thinks the whole thing's a bit funny. That one of my dear mates who still lives down in Dorset where he lives, walked past him and outside a pub as per, and she said, one of them said, have you heard Jess's news or whatever? And they both said, yeah, of course. And she said to him, well done, Keith. Like, you've been really sound about it. You've been really lovely. And he went, have I done it right? And he seemed so, he had no idea whether he'd had the right reaction. I mean, nor am I. It did involve the word bender. It's not ideal. But
but it's the intent, isn't it? He wasn't,
with that generation. Yeah. It just is the intent, you know.
So Jess Foster Q, again, a fantastic chat. I've known Jess for years, and it's been nice to see someone on there, you know, they're like, you know, blossoming and finding out who they really are. It's been a joy to see that growth, and I, you know, I, like I said at the beginning, I feel I've grown since doing this podcast.
the man that set me on my journey and one of our first guests is Mr. Michael Smiley. And the man I met him, I mean, I knew him from the TV show Spaced. And I know I've said that on the episode, but when I met him, the man, he changed my life. He really put me on a different path. And without him, I wouldn't be where I am now. And I will never not be ungrateful. I will forever be grateful to Michael Smiley for everything he's done for me. And he's one of those, I'm a lucky man to have him in my life. And you could tell on this as well, it's one of our favourite interviews over the last 2 years. Not only mine, it was a fan favourite as well, to the point that we used it as our listening party on social media. We actually played the episode and we got people to listen to it. And then we were commenting on Twitter and Michael joined in. Scroobius Pitt was joining in and a few others. And it was a real moment. It was really nice that happened. So, look, thank you for listening to this show. Thank you for your continued support. I'm going to let Michael finish the show. It's our 100th show. It's 2 years in. And he talks about his parents. He talks about his own experiences of parenting. And we had a beautiful moment, Smiley and I, just wonderful, beautiful, emotional hug at the end of the episode. It was a wonderful moment. Again, thank you for listening to us. And we'll see you next time on Insane in the Membrane.
I had always had a thing with my kids, which is that trying to teach them when enough's enough.
Mm.
To be able to say, yeah, look, this is what that good is really funny, but if it goes on too long, it becomes tedious and boring, and then you'll be told to shut the fuck up. Yeah. So the shorthand was first time great, second time all right, third time enough, third time no.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
So is that the sort of the law of three, even the law of three within comedy?
Of course, you know? Yes. You know?
But it's that way of sort of passing on what you've learnt. Not because if you have wisdom, it's because I've been down that road.
Yeah.
And I know what that road, where that road leads to.
Yeah, yeah,
that
road
leads to you being told to go to bed early because you're becoming a pain in the arse.
Yeah.
So that's why you can't have that extra glass of Coca-Cola at 7 o'clock. You know what I mean? That's why that's not happening.
Because you're going to be pirouetting around
And I'm going to sit and talk to you about it and explain it to you. So then the next time I tell you, that's the second time I've told you, and the third time. And I've said to my kids, you don't want to see this face.
Yeah.
So why don't we do it
like this way? Yeah.
Do it this way. You know, one of the things that I've been consistently most of my life is a dad.
Yeah.
You know, I've been a dad since I was a wee lad.
Yeah.
You know, similar to yourself.
Same. Absolutely. Yeah.
Young fathers.
Yeah, man.
And, you know, I was a dad from when I was 20.
Same. Yeah.
And, you know, so that's weird because, like, me and you're born the same day. Yeah, I'm a bit older than you, but that thing of your life being measured by, you know, I was a dad when I was before I was a man.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And I've grew up with my kids, but also that thing of that you didn't have, you tried to have carefree days, but you couldn't.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You no matter what I did that was a wee bit spicy, in the back of my head, there was that thing of, oh, you've got a kid.
Yeah, man. Yeah.
Everybody else is flying their kite and they're doing that in their 20s.
I always had one hand on the ground.
Yeah.
And just,
you've got a kid. Yeah, whether you like it or not, you can not see them. You can have a bad relationship with the wife. She can be your ex. You maybe never had a relationship with her. But you've still got a kid.
Yeah.
You can't have an ex-kid.
No.
Right? Like my dad, the day that my eldest was born, my dad, I was just in that sort of washing machine head. I didn't know what really was going on. Everything just had happened. It's happened. It's, you know, and saying to my dad, holding this wee, beautiful wee baby boy in my arms, and my dad, I said, New Year's Day, saying to him, what do you think? And my dad looked at me and went, toothpaste out of the tube now, son. Don't be pushing that back in again. My dad was, was a misogynist in any way, but he would never make himself a cup of tea.
No.
My mom made him a cup of tea. And it was, what was celebrated was my dad's Christmas stuffing for the turkey.
Yeah, right. Yeah, there's always, making a curry on Friday.
That's Christmas, my dad's going to do the stuffing.
Yeah.
Like once a year.
Yeah, that was it.
But that's not to say he was, he was always curious, and I think I've still got I got that from him. My dad was always curious about the difference between men and women, how men view things, how women view things. So that was always up for debate.
Yeah.
And also, he was married to my mother, and my mother was a lioness.
Right.
She was fierce.
Yeah.
And very loving and very fierce. You wouldn't want to get on the wrong side of Alice.
No, no.
But and she was quick. She was inner city. Her sense of humour was very inner city.
Right.
When I was from inner city Belfast. And one of the most beautiful things, I remember I was over doing a thing. Both my parents have passed on now. And I was staying in this hotel, or this B&B called the Rayan House. If you're ever in Northern Ireland near Hollywood, go and stay in the Rayan House.
Right.
It's the only 5-star B&B in the whole of Ireland. they do the Titanic menu.
Okay.
And some honest, they do the menu from the Titanic.
Wow.
But also the husband and wife team that run it, impeccable food.
Yeah.
The award-winning, the breakfasts are just unbelievable. I've never seen a breakfast like it. You know, say 3-4 pages long, you can choose from your breakfasts.
And, yeah.
So I stayed there, and I'm walking along, it's on Domain Road, which is along the back road, near a Hollywood Golf Club or Rory McIlroy country, right? So it's quite detached house.
Okay.
Posh houses,
yeah. Right?
And I used to do my paper round along there when I was a kid. So I'm walking into Hollywood one morning, and to have a coffee and reminiscing. Both my parents are dead. I'm walking along that street, this road, Domain Road, and I'm remembering all the little things that I have. You know, going back, I haven't been home in 35 years, so everything's like a little memory.
Yeah,
I'll get a smell and a certain place, and I passed this house. That my mother used to clean in. She was a cleaner, and I was a wee kid. And I remember...
And did you go with her a lot of the time?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And this house had an orchard in the front garden, and I climbed one of the trees and took one of the apples, and the woman came out, and she ripped me a new one.
Right.
And I remember every time I've walked past that house, I always have that memory. And I'd have been about 6 or 7, and I remember my ma being mortified. And not... pretending to have a go at me and tell me off, but actually she was annoyed with this woman, but it was her job, she was a cleaner.
Yeah.
Da, da, da.
Yeah.
Anyway, fucking middle class. Okay. Anyway, I'm at that, here's the God's honest truth, I'm at that point, looking at that house, having that memory, and I looked, and as I said, I've been away from home a long time, so you see faces of, I see old Hollywood faces,
right,
and I go, I know you, but I don't know your name, or whatever, right? And this guy come walking towards me. He's, "Oh, Michael, how you doing? You over for a wee while?" And here's me, I'm over, I'm doing a TV show. He says, "Oh, good to see you. It's good, always good to see you on the TV." He says, "I work with your mother down in the ordnance. My mum was a stitcher in the ordnance depot.
Right, right, right.
And he said, "I work with Alice down the Remy there in the ordnance depot." Here's me, "All right." And he says, "Aye, your mother, great woman, great woman." I said, "Oh, thanks very much." He says, "Aye." He says, "Aye, Alice, word mechanic. She was a word mechanic." And he walked off. And I just heard word mechanic. And
yeah.
I just thought, what a beautiful, that sums up Northern Ireland to me. It sums up that, you know, that you're not having a massive vocabulary, but using the least amount of words to get across, to paint the biggest picture.
Yeah.
To call my mother a word mechanic.
Beautiful.
And a man of a certain age who would have, what he's basically saying was, you wouldn't get the better offer.
No.
And she was quick, and she was quicker than the man.
Yeah.
If I can say that to you now, you know what I mean? And there's me thinking about my ma, and this guy comes around the corner and gives me the best homage to my mother and then walks on. And it really choked me, you know, because there was something... Oh, I'm getting upset now.
No, man.
There was something really quite spiritual about it. Because I'm thinking about them, and as I'm thinking about her, I believe when people die or they pass on, if you talk about them, you call them back. And because I was thinking about her, and then he come round the corner and just walked in and told me something beautiful about my mother.
Yeah.
It was like, it was a God-given thing. It was a God-given thing.
Beautiful.
It was like, I was being blessed to have those thoughts.
Yeah.
At that moment.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You know, it was a blessing.
You were open to it,
My God went to me, there you go.
There you go,
miss your man, Dan, you love your man, Dan. Here's a lovely wee,
a little gift for you.
Here's a wee gift for you.
Beautiful.
And that's why I'm telling that story. And the whatever tears I have now are not of sadness. They're just because I'm a sentimental old fart. Yeah.
But that's beautiful.
And the more you're away from home, the more sentimental you become. And the older you get, the more sentimental you become. And all those things are lovely.
Yeah.
All those things are lovely. It's not a fear of death. It's not a fear of what you're losing out on. It's actually, I become less emotionally eloquent and I become more emotional.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
Made by darkhorsedigital.co.uk. Shooting, live streaming, and podcast production.